Hello and welcome to Hightailing Through History, a history podcast where two sisters get high and surprise each other with a story from history's vault of the weird and the wonderful. I'm Laurel, the older sister.
I'm Katie, making me the younger sister by process of elimination.
There's two of us. Well, actually, now if you're watching, there's three of us. So you're like, oh, do we gain a new family member all of a sudden? So we always love to be joined by new history-loving friends here in the Smoke Circle. And joining us today is Justin McHenry, author of the really fun-to-read and incredibly interesting book, Lemuria, A True Story of a Fake Place. Justin, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I feel like the unofficial third sister now, so that's good.
You are now adopted into the family as the third sister. Welcome.
Thank goodness. Okay, well, it's a pleasure to be here at this family reunion. It's an honor, really. Thank you, guys.
Now, we're so glad to have you, and this is our season finale for season two, and I feel like we're really truly ending it on a weird and wonderful bang. We are about the weird history today, folks.
It's about the end of the world, literally, like the end of one world for not only the podcast, but a whole lost continent. So it's appropriate.
Oh, I'm so excited to talk about it. And I suppose we always have our sort of formalities of each episode where we go, hey, Katie, what are you drinking? I know it's 10 o'clock in the morning for us here, but do you have anything that you are chilling out with today?
Breakfast smoothie. And a half an edible.
Breakfast smoothie and half an edible. There it is.
What's in the smoothie? What's the smoothie consist of?
It's strawberry, banana, half a cup of whole milk, 2 tablespoons of yogurt, and I put oats in there, like Bob's Red Mill gluten-free oats.
Okay.
And then flax seeds, my collagen, local bee pollen. I sound like such a nerd right now. Local honey. I'm trying to think what else I put. I think that's, and a half a teaspoon of vanilla extract.
Well, yeah, you need that flavor.
Mm-hmm. Madagascar.
Yeah. Wow, there you go. That's perfect.
You know what? I feel like with each of those ingredients, you were just canceling out a little bit of that edible, you know, where people are like, wow. I mean, I think that's how that works. You just have a little balance out there.
Health and drugs. And drugs.
The two. No, that's great. It sounds like a wonderful smoothie you've made there. That's fantastic. Because I'm a drinks goblin, I have water, as usual, and a cup of coffee.
Nice.
And then because I am also balancing out with some drugs, I have I had some a gelato that I had to smoke earlier today.
Wait.
So,
nice.
Not, hold up. Not like ice cream gelato.
Oh, man. No. I was like, what? That's a thing.
Yeah, I was like, is that what they're doing in Illinois now?
I know. I was like, where did you get that? And why do I not have any?
Yeah.
Sorry, so gelato. Gelato as the strain name, but it's like, it's more of that, one of those like creative brain, you know.
Gotcha.
It's like having a cup of coffee and then a cup of coffee and that kind of thing. So
oh wow, okay. You're gonna be wired.
Yeah. I know.
Yeah. Like, let's talk some history. you know, so speaking of history, all that for a segue. Justin, I always like to ask our guests, what got you into history? What pulled you in? Is there a certain event or person or thing that you learned about that sparked that fire?
I've always liked stories, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I found like almost an infinite amount of stories in history. And so just being able to research and just find little tidbits and nuggets here and there and was, it's just so exciting for me. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of weird because I like discovered that about myself in high school. And then, you know, being from West Virginia, I wanted to get away from West Virginia so badly just because it was West Virginia. There's not a lot going on here. That's okay though. But, so I was going to go to school for Latin American history. And so I get to college and get it going on the stuff. And then I think trying to learn Spanish was incredibly difficult for me, but, I ended up getting into West Virginia history for some reason. And so that's what that's what kept me here, was, I guess, discovering this love of the state and the history of the state. And so, and just discovering all of the stories going on around here.
I was going to say, when you said you're in West Virginia, you're like, not a lot happens here. I was like, listen, that sounds magical. Would you say the Blue Mountains? What was the other thing you said?
Shenandoah? The Blue Ridge, the Blue Ridge Mountains are right beside me. The Shenandoah River. That's where the Shenandoah River and the Potomac meet at Harper's Ferry. And that's where John Brown's raid happened. And there's a whole bunch of stuff. I'm in Charlestown, West Virginia right now. And that's where they hung John Brown. And so there's just a bunch of history. All of Yeah, right. I was going to say the spot where they hung John Brown, the guy who hung him, like the executioner, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
He bought the property and then he built a house on top of it. But it was just up for sale like 2 years ago, that the house. So there's some good, I guess, John Brown ghost vibes.
If I was John Brown, I would haunt his ass so much.
Yeah, right?
Like straight up.
That's just asking for it at that point.
It really is. Really is.
Yeah.
Especially with like a bunch of white people just living in that house stuff. You have to haunt it.
I'd haunt it. Haunt it so hard. That sounds perfect. And yeah, I mean, we're Illinoisans, so we understand, you know, there's some interesting bits of history in our own state. And then there's some things that you're like, all right. That's cool. But yeah, what a rich area of the country that you live in terms of just, I mean, scenery and landscape, but the history there too.
So, yeah. It's great. I kind of lucked out because I'm from Southern West Virginia and I went to college as far away as possible that I could, but still stay in state to get that cheaper tuition and stuff like that. So that's how I ended up over here.
So you're a West Virginian historian then, is how that, like that official title.
Yeah, I guess so. my master's degree is in West Virginia history, and I still write some of it. All that
don't mean to rub that in at all. Sorry about that.
Right. No,
that's amazing. That's great. We love the history lovers on our show, and especially those who pursue it and, you know, and further that education. I think it's so cool because you guys have a lot to talk about and to share with nerds like us, like history.
Yeah.
Correct term.
Yeah.
And there are there's so many stories, as you mentioned, so many interesting, fascinating, wonderful things to learn in history. And so what took you down to the mysterious and weird journey that is Lemuria?
Like you guys, I love history. I also love weird stuff, and I love the history of weird things. And so being in that realm, I just picked up bits and pieces of the Lemurian story over the years. Like probably I knew about the Blavatsky Lemuria. I knew about the Shaver mysteries and how that connected with Lemuria. And so like when the pandemic came around and I was kind of stuck in my house and I was looking for stuff to do, I was like, well, why don't I start researching something and maybe try to write a book? And so knowing about Lemuria, and I went and there was like, hasn't really been anything seriously written about it before. So I was like, well, this is a good opportunity. Let's dive into it. And I know it touches a bunch of different topics too. So that excited me, just being able to go down and wade into weird rivers and things like that. So it was, it was exciting. So
I also love weird history. And I do listen to podcasts that, where they talk about, you know, like Mothman or something like that. Like, hey, let's talk about Mothman and sightings and stuff like that. I think that's just fun. And the folklore of that, I think, is really fascinating. Especially interesting to know that there is some like real history behind some of these things that maybe has been twisted and turned around to resemble something completely different. You do a really excellent job conveying that real history, but then also how this concept gets tangled up in pseudoscience and like new age spirituality. So it's such a pleasure to read.
And we're
going to have all the show notes and to what you're doing as well as to the book too. So people can also pick this up because it's great. Here it is.
There you go.
There's a little lemur on the front.
It would have a lemur on it.
And there's one right behind
you. Do you know lemurs bite millipedes to get high because it gives off psychoactive effects?
I did not know that.
Ooh, you can check it out. They sit there and they're like,
Sounds like such a lemur thing, though. They're very chill. It? Yeah. They're very lazy creatures as well, too. So I appreciated that about them.
Lemur stoners.
Millipedes. Oh.
There you go. Yeah.
It's like, you know, licking the frog, that same sort of thing, because of how poisonous millipedes are, that kind of thing.
I just know that because I was never destined to be normal in this world. Instead of watching, I watch cartoons, but most of the time as a kid, if you walked in, it was the Animal Planet on, because okay. I was like, this is way more interesting than anything else going on. Yeah. And it was talking about lemurs, and you know how they just kind of like stroll around with their tails up like a cat kind of?
Yeah.
They're doing that. And then they're like walked in this like clearing in Madagascar of these ring-tailed lemurs. And they're just sitting there, and they, like, the millipede rolls up, and they just bite on them. And yeah. The millipede releases this secretion, which is actually a defensive mechanism for them, right?
Yeah.
And it makes them, like how catnip makes cats, like, it's like dropping acid. Mm-hmm. The lemurs are, like, dropping millipede acid, and they're just sitting there. And they literally have their hands out like this, and they're just, like, sitting there, like, just, like, zoned out, like, yeah. Hardcore. This is mm-hmm. The funniest thing I've ever seen. It's amazing.
Oh, I love it. That's amazing. I love it. They just somehow got even better in my mind now. So thank you for it.
Not sure.
Anytime.
Yeah, it really is. They were already at the tippy top, but now nothing can
Now there's a further gap between first and second place.
It really is, yeah.
For sure. Our listeners, just so y'all know what's going on, Justin and I are going to be talking about his book, and we're going to do a little run through of the story and give you all an idea in the scale at which this is all happening in. And Katie's been kept in the dark about it. She just knows Lemuria is on the table, and I don't even know how much Katie knows or doesn't know about Lemuria, but she's then going to surprise us all with her own little weird-ass slice of history. So we're going to have such a grand old time. So Lemuria, as I mentioned earlier, to me, it was like the mythical equivalent of Atlantis. Like long, long ago, a landmass existed and was populated by, like, air quotes here, like higher beings and the, you know, maybe alien race or super, you know, super species. And that's a very basic understanding that I had when I came to the book. It's all I knew. So knowing it has a very real history behind it is wild to me that it wasn't just something totally made up. But the concept of Lemuria is born in science. As you start in your book, it's born in science, like actual, hey, we're going to study it and write about it and try and figure out theories around it. So Justin, can you just start us out with like the birth of Lemuria? Like what is it for one, I guess, okay. Everyone knows. And then how does it first get mentioned in history?
Yeah, sure. So how I like to explain Lemuria to people, because everybody does know basically what Atlantis is. So Lemuria is, so what Atlantis is to the Atlantic Ocean, Lemuria is to the Pacific and Indian Ocean. It's the great long lost continent of those oceans. And it shares a lot of similarities with Atlantis. There was an advanced civilization that lived there, like Atlantis. Lemurian also had like a rapid, catastrophic demise, like Atlantis had. And they're often like kind of lumped together as well. So when you have people talking about Lemuria, historically, it is, you know, as part of a timeline where Lemuria precedes Atlantis in this kind of like metaphysical history. And it set the stage for it culturally, too. Like, so Lemuria culturally influenced Atlanteans and that kind of thing. But Lemuria has its own whole other mythology that has been formed around it. And it's like, it's proved to be very malleable and it kind of shifts all over the place. And where for Atlantis, the discourse surrounding it has kind of settled it to being kind of... thought to be a real place to most people, or just a representation of, you know, different cultures around like the Mediterranean, things like that. Lemurian, on the other hand, is just goes straight out bonkers real quickly. it is, I like explaining it like it's like your cool cousin who are all like, you know, buy you cigarettes and let you drink and like let you listen to like Def Leppard and shit like that. But it's also where you're like, where like lost continents go to let their hair down and like have a good time. It's like, you know, it's filled with all kinds of weird creatures. There's cyclops, there's jelly sack like beings, there's giants, there's, you know, ascended masters with telekinetic Jedi powers as well. And so it is super fun. It's a place, I don't know if I would love to live there, but I think spending like a vacation there would be amazing.
It sure sounds just a visit.
Wild.
Yeah.
it gets pretty wild. It's a wild ride. And what's funny, you were talking about lemurs earlier, Katie. So that's where it gets its starts from, too. So there was this British ornithologist, a guy who studies birds, in the 1860s, and he was just studying the mammals of Madagascar. And so he was giving this talk in England. And so he gets to lemurs, and he's like, well, we have lemur-like species in South America. We have lemur-like species in Africa. We have actual lemurs in Madagascar, and we have like lemur-like species in Asia. So there had to have been some connecting tissue of land that accounts for all of these different species. And so he theorized this land bridge that connected everything. And at the very, very end of his talk, he goes, let's just call this land bridge Lemuria. And the name just stuck. Oh. Yeah. And then so it has this kind of real history, real foundation in like actual scientific ideas and concepts going on in the 19th century. And then it just gets brought into other scientific debates that are going on at the time too.
I really think there's something to be said about science in the 19th century. Like, what a fascinating wild west of
it's truly amazing. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And people were like, they were multi-hyphenates too. They mm-hmm. weren't like specialists like we think of scientists today, where you just are only interested in, you know, lemur biology or whatever. No, these people were. One guy in the book, Alfred Russel Wallace, he was into bugs. He was into like disproving the flat Earth. He was into finding life on Mars, and like it's just like a wide range. And he was also like the leading Darwinist of the era as well. So he's like only second to Darwin when it comes to like evolutionary theory in the 19th century. And so they were very much like generalist and just interested in so much stuff.
It's something where I feel like also with our 21st century like retrospection, like we can look back on some of these things that they were studying in the 19th century and be like, oh, okay, I'm seeing your path there. I'm understanding your observations and the hypotheses you're getting from that and how you're planning to study that. That's cool. And then sometimes, and I find it more maybe with specific fields of science and others, but there's a certain point where sometimes they just kind of diverge, and then you're like, oh man, I was rooting for you there. Right? I was rooting for you, and then you took your you know, your science and you kind of made it into something that you wanted it to be, which kind of seems like was the case with Lemuria. When other scientists started getting involved with it, they're trying to make it fit into their own box of what they wanted it to be to support their science. Who was the main scientist that like literally and proverbially, I guess, kind of put it on the map to make that happen, where there's that sort of rolling forward with other scientists?
Yeah. So you were talking about like, I was rooting for you, but then you made it weird. That's Ernst Haeckel, like for Lemuria, just because he goes in like this white supremacist, like racial aspect to things. But he was one of the leading like evolutionary theorists of the 19th century as well. He was a German German scientist, zoologist, who did a lot of like early work in like proving Darwin's theories about natural selection and things like that. And he was like a fanboy of Darwin as well. He would send Darwin his like press clippings and all of his articles and stuff like that. But it was like reciprocal too, because Darwin appreciated all of the like the hard science work that he was doing. But he wrote a book after On the Origin of Species came out called The History of Creation. And he actually put Lemuria on the map, because where Darwin did not really go into human evolution and on the origins of species, like that was Haeckel's big thing in the History of Creation. He goes like hardcore deep into like how we developed from, you know, apes and things like that. And so he, for him, he needed a place, like a paradise for this evolution to occur. And for that, like Lemuria, like was the perfect piece of land right there in the middle of the Indian Ocean for him to have this development, but also have, the different like races of man be able to, veer off of from Lemuria and populate the rest of the world. So he was the one that actually like put people onto Lemuria. And then once people were on Lemuria, he never took them off.
It's theirs now. That's it.
Exactly. It's what's like this, what humans do. We just take over and conquer. And yeah. Stuff, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the human condition right there.
It really is. It really is. And so, yeah, he was very influential. His book, The History of Creation, went through tons and tons of editions. And so for the time, it was as popular as like a scientific work could be, going through, you know, and when it was translated into English and went through many English editions, and he would keep updating it as well, going forward throughout his life with all the newest, like research into evolution, he would add that into it and tweaks things and stuff like that. So it was almost like a textbook in a way too, because it was just being updated so much. So, but it was popular work, and it was popular for, you know, Germans too. And so he had this thing of putting the Germanic race at the top. Who could have guessed that from a German scientist, right? And so,
yeah. If Lemuria was once based in science, and it was, you know, it was spoken about at least in like legitimate science circles, how does one take such a hard left? They've diverged for sure, yeah. And to be embraced by cultists and or like, you know, alternative metaphysical new age spirituality, like that realm of things.
Yeah.
So where did that happen?
Well, that happened like directly with Madame Blavatsky. So Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, who was this Russian mystic, basically. But she was incredibly intelligent woman who was, she created the Theosophical Society, which is like a, you know, metaphysical organization that's still around today, still very much, you know, around today and just popular today as well, especially in those circles. But she really has a good understanding and foundation in like Darwinist theories. And so she was taking those and basically creating like straw men out of them to act as a counterforce for her ideas about like spiritual evolution. And so she takes where for Ernst Haeckel, Lemuria was the cradle of humanity, like where humanity developed. For Blavatsky, Lemuria became the cradle for spirituality. It's where man in our spiritual evolutionary journey, you know, comes of age, comes of a, you know, religious and metaphysical and spiritual awakening happening there on Lemuria and all of the Lemurians there. But at the same time, a bunch of crazy stuff was going on. That's where we have Cyclops. She has it. She along with that spiritual evolution, there's a physical evolution going on as well. And so we start as gaseous beings at the beginning of the Lemurian age, and then slowly morph into giants, Cyclops. And then as our eye develops into two, the pituitary gland in the middle of our head starts to develop into a third eye, and we can, you know, communicate over long distances and then that sort of thing.
Yeah, I made a note.
It is. I would say, so that's all written about in the Secret Doctrine, her like 1200 page multi-volume work. It's the densest crap you ever like could even think about. So to get all of that detail, it's like 500 pages here and there. It's really hard, but it's super fascinating.
Yeah. I made a note that said, girl has some huge ideas about Lemuria.
Yeah, she does. She does.
Some big ideas. I actually had sent you a message when I was in her chapter four. I was actually reading it in public too, which was fun. And I was like, my face at pages 77 and 78, and it was like, yeah. Like, mm-hmm. She's got some ideas. But it's really interesting how, and this is not just exclusive to her, but just other scientists and people that are latching onto Lemuria over time, using science and then cherry picking it to make it fit into this and be like, okay, well then now I can add my own little flavor to it, like Madame Blavatsky did. And now it's this whole thing with tiers of people and Cyclops and all these different things. And this is where everything is evolving and coming from and then going to. And I was like, wow, there is some big lore here.
Yeah. I will give her credit though. Like, at least she was citing everything that as she was going along through it. And so, yeah, you know where her ideas are coming from, even if it's, yeah, she's citing her, her made up books that only she has access to in her made up language, like, but she's still citing that. And she's citing Ernst Haeckel and all this other stuff to bring it forward. So you know where she's getting her ideas, but people who come after her, you don't have that that connection. They're just pulling stuff from everywhere and they don't care.
What?
No, that's just the beginning too. It's not even weird yet, honestly.
So when does it get weird? Weirder, I guess I should say.
Yeah, it gets weirder right like after her. So you have this like second wave of Theosophists. So right after she dies, there's like a infighting within the Theosophical Society. And you have this like this lady, Annie Besant, who was a very interesting lady herself. She was like very deeply involved in like Indian home rule movement and working alongside Gandhi to like bring about the end of the British colonialism in India and stuff like that. But she teams up with this just degenerate guy by the name of Charles W. Leadbeater. And for some reason, she can't quit him. But they do these like, they get together and they do these things where they project themselves back in time and do these like past life projections. And so they would go to like famous people and stuff like that, and they'll write biographies about how they would project themselves back in time. And so they did that with
my edibles hitting right as you're saying this. I was like, what?
It's the perfect, I think, edible story for you.
Yeah. Putting on my seatbelt, click, button up. I'm ready, you guys. This shit just got wild. Like, it just went from really weird to like, I'm on a ride right now. Who needs Disney World when I've got you guys? I'm here for all of it.
There you go. So they projected themselves back to Lemuria. And their Lemuria is basically ancient Earth. So like pre-dinosaur Earth. And there's like humans there. And so they have beings from Venus or beings from Moon and Mars coming down to Earth on wicker baskets to teach the humans there how to be civilization. And so they get down there and they teach our early ancestors how to be humans, basically. And then they're fighting dinosaurs and stuff like that while they're doing it and things like that. Yeah. So,
but why wicker baskets? Like,
wicker baskets at all?
Yes, that was just like, I don't think wicker holds up to intergalactic travel, but
I mean, I wasn't gonna say it. You did, but I literally sat on because we're like going to thrift stores to try and like find like different furniture and stuff like that because we're building a bourbon lounge for Blake. And I sat in a little like wicker love seat. Turns around, looks at me like 2 seconds. He goes, I hate wicker. Get out of it. We're not buying anything. I was like, okay, I didn't know you had such strong wicker opinions. All right, I'll just crush all of my outdoor furniture dreams right now then.
Oh,
why wicker?
I don't know. It makes a lot of noise too, so I can only imagine the
not quiet.
Yeah, the how it sounds just going from Mars to the Earth here in a wicker basket.
So you're gonna hunt dinosaurs, and yet you arrived in a wicker basket. All right.
Yep.
And those are the like the ascended masters. Those are the elevated creatures are arriving in a wicker basket too. So it's not like the humans here are just building wicker.
Right. You know. Do they have wicker capabilities on Mars and the moon? Because I have, I'm telling you right now, like, I've got a lot of problems with this specific detail. And I don't think wicker would hold up upon atmospheric entry. I'm pretty sure shit lights on fire. I'm no expert here, but, like, I know some shit about some things, especially dinosaurs. And I'm going to tell you, I don't know. What? I don't buy it.
Well, why do you don't think there's like no trees on Mars or the moon? Like there was extensive deforestation due to the wicker needs.
It was, that's you what it was. What?
I think we're onto something right now.
it's really a metaphor for our environment today for us. So
that's what the dark side of the moon is hiding.
Mm-hmm. The wicker fields.
Decimated wicker fields.
So yeah, they've had their wicker basket adventures, and where does it go from there? I mean,
I feel like America really... after that, yeah, that's where it goes to.
We take it to Florida with this level of weird, but anyway. Yeah.
What's funny is like I couldn't find it in Blavatsky, but the second wave of Theosophists, they had a very clear idea that the end of it's seven root races. And so you have these seven root races. And so the second to last root race, the sixth root race is supposed to rise up here in America. And then the seventh race is actually Lemuria risen again and will take place there. And then we'll be, you know, fully realized spiritual beings. And so I that's part of why I think it comes to America is just to have this elevated ascended masters being on here. But it comes to America in the form of Lemurians living within Mount Shasta. And they're having parties there on Mount Shasta. So Mount Shasta is this beautiful looking mountain in the northern, almost northernmost part of California. This guy by the name of Harvey Spencer Lewis, he's writing under the fake name Wishar Survey. He wrote this book called The Lemuria, The Lost Land of the Pacific, I believe. And so he's a Rosicrucian. He started his own Rosicrucian organization there in California. And he comes up with this idea of there being Lemurians living within Mount Shasta. And they're doing a whole bunch of kind of crazy fun stuff there. They're, you know, having parties. There's a force field around Mount Shasta, so you can't drive a car near it because it like stalls out and stuff like that. you have a guy down in Pasadena, at his observatory, being able to observe what's going on at Mount Shasta. So Mount Shasta from Pasadena is about 500 miles, and so maybe on a flat Earth you can see that happening, but on a curved earth, you can't really tell what's going on from Pasadena on Mount Shasta, but he was witnessing all of this going on and stuff like that. And so people started coming to Mount Shasta and having their own personal experiences in and around the mountain. And so it really kicks off in the 1930s, this like golden age of weird stuff happening at Mount Shasta. So you have people having like
only in the 1930s right now. Like what?
right now in the 1930s. And it's so fascinating. And they start having like little people encounters with like gnome like creatures. Like it's like fairy. There's a lot of Bigfoot sightings, like breastfeeding Bigfoot. That was the most fun one, was like some guy seeing Bigfoot breastfeeding a baby Bigfoot, and that kind of stuff going on.
A lady squatch and a baby squatch. Now I've seen it all.
Yeah, right. and it gets strange because so many people are coming there. They're bothering the Forest Service, who is controlling the Mount Shasta as it's, you know, a national park and whatnot. And so they have to release a statement saying, you know, we've flown over Mount Shasta. We've taken pictures of every inch of this place. There's no Lemurian places going on here. There's no Lemurian cities or buildings or anything like that going on. And then the Rosicrucians kind of had to print a retraction and say, because y'all knuckleheads are going to Mount Shasta and looking for Lemurians, that scared off all the Lemurians. So they hightailed it down to Mexico.
Of course.
Now I'm not going to tell you where they're at now because I don't want you bothering them.
They're in Tijuana partying there. That's where they decided to go next. Oh my gosh.
They should bring a lot of suntan lotion because the Lemurians there are very much these like tall, white, Nordic creatures. Very much similar with, if you're familiar with like UFO lore, like the early contactees and like the idea of there being tall whites. And so you can almost see it as an antecedent to those two.
Yeah, Katie, I see your face. It's like Rivendell, like just the most blondie, tall, ethereal sort of.
Yeah, you know, I was going to say, so I'm just going to say, I see a lot of this lore is very wrapped up in like white supremacy, is what it sounds like. Okay, that's what I was like, this is what I'm picking up right now.
Yeah, and there's a definite change too, because you get like Heichel and Blavatsky, Lemuria was just a place where the races kind of separated and went off, and that happened. But now it's become a land of like ascended white masters. And I'm not sure how that happened or why that happened. It's just, I guess when white people get together with other white people, they have to like put themselves above everybody else. And so, or as leading examples too. And so if you see, there's a picture of Harvey Spencer Lewis in the book and you can see he's not like a true fine example of the white race as a lot of people are. So
put a picture up there for everybody. See it. How did pop culture and like more mainstream attention get brought to Lemuria and its lore?
Yeah, well, it kind of happens through science fiction. And so you have this tandem of a writer and an editor getting together and bringing Lemuria more into the like kind of American consciousness. The writer is Richard Shaver, who was kind of a targeted individual, what we would call maybe now today. He had a lot of ideas that there were people out there to get him. And there were in particular these underground dwarven evil dwarves called Darrows. He called them Darrows, and they were attacking him and basically responsible for all the ills that are going on in the world today. So anything from like stealing your car keys to, you know, World War II, like these Darrows are responsible for it all. He was institutionalized throughout the 1930s. And then as soon as he gets out of being institutionalized, he writes a letter to Amazing Stories, which was a classic pulp. It's one of his stories, actually. Yeah. Magazine from the 1940s. It was edited by a guy named Ray Palmer. And so he writes this crazy letter to the editor there where he creates his own alphabet. And there's a whole backstory behind it that's really complicated to do. But he says this alphabet is from this ancient civilization that was once on Earth. Ray Palmer writes him back. He publishes the letter. The letter gets like huge amount of response from all of the readers. Ray Palmer reaches out to Shaver and is like, do you have a story? Let's like write this story. And so they write a story together called I Remember Lemuria. And it tells the story of Lemuria. So Lemuria is just another name for like the ancient Earth. And so there's these two giants civilizations on like, and I mean giant, like 400 foot, like giant people living on Earth at the time. And they were battling then they became allergic to the sun, and so they dug down into the earth and created this huge cavern world. And they used ray technologies for everything too. But then, and they built robots to do all of the work for them. And those robots are humans, so we're the robots. And so when Earth became too unstable for them, they left. They hightailed it to someplace else, and they left us here as robots. And so some of us like ascended and went back up to the top, but some of us became evil and stayed underground. And so, and the whole idea around this, so it's kind of silly and ridiculous, but he believed this, right? Mm-hmm. Like this was all happening or all happened to Shaver. And that's how they put these stories out there as like real stories that were happening. And so it took off and became huge. And so for about a year and a half, he wrote a series of other stories around this whole idea of there being this underground race of beings and stuff like that. It's called the Shaver Mysteries. That's what it kind of came to be known as, the Shaver Mysteries.
His story is, it was so fascinating to me, but it's also so heartbreaking. You know,
it is.
That whole arc that he had of that. But these things that he perceived as real and happening to, they get put in comic books. What an interesting turn.
Yeah, and it gets big press too. Like Time Magazine is writing about it. It gets written in a lot of the press of the day as well. It's receiving a lot of ideas, and it's really probably the most that Lemuria has been talked about before or since. So this was all happening in the late 1940s, right after World War II. So it's slowly bringing its way to the front, and then like Lemuria starts getting hijacked by like new age the new age movement that was coming around in the early starts in the 50s and really into the 1960s.
So what would you say is like the, I guess, where Lemuria is now, not necessarily its physical location, but where is Lemuria left, I guess I should say.
Yeah. Well, it's like a spice now. It's kind of just like a little thing you throw into a bigger soup of like new age woo-woo kind of stuff. It's something to give you a little bit more street cred.
It's a bay leaf.
Yeah, it's really kind of is.
Oh. Yeah.
So yeah, I was talking about Amy Carlson earlier, and so part of her backstory is that she was a former queen of Lemuria, and so that's where you get a lot of the Lemuria today. Is you get the idea of the Lemurian seed crystals.
There it is.
Yeah, and also Lemuria as like a land of persecution as well. It's become a cautionary tale for like right wing elements or the new right elements going on today. It's kind of what happens when you allow wokeness to control a society, and it actually destroys a society. And so that society that, these political correctness and stuff has destroyed, or science has destroyed, was responsible for destroying Lemuria.
Yeah, right. I know. A lot to take in.
It is. It really is. It's so wild. But as I was going through the book, there were, as I said, there's little snippets and stories of things that I have heard of and knew about, and I was like, oh, here are the Mayans. Oh, here are the underground giant people in Mount Shasta. Mm-hmm. All these little for me that were just little blips on the radar there. Is part of the greater web that is like Lemuria has those different connections to all these things, or at least people who have taken their own thread of theory and thought process through it. And I thought that was really interesting that a lot of things popped up along the way to connect with it.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good summary of what Lemuria is. It's a blank slate that allows all of that to happen on there. So a lot of people just like project what their interests are, what they are into, onto Lemuria, and that's what Lemuria becomes for them.
No, I love the story, and so thank you so much for bringing that to us, because it is, Katie, it is such a wild ride, and that's why I wanted to keep you in the dark about it, because I knew that you'd be like, what?
It all started with lemurs, too. That's the
and lemurs.
Lemurs aren't actually like that big a part of it like I thought they would be, but I thought for sure there were going to be lemur people in it.
That's what they're missing out. They need some lemur people to add to Lemuria, like, you know.
That's where lemurs. The seed crystals come from. So seed crystals were seeded by extraterrestrials, hundreds of thousands, millions of years ago. So extraterrestrials came here, planted these crystal seeds in the Earth to act as fuel for their intergalactic travels, right? They enrolled lemurs to act as the protectors of these seed gardens. But then dinosaurs came along and their masculine energy scared the lemurs off. And so that left the seed fields open for humans to find them. And so we've been mining them. And now we can, unlock the power of Lemurian crystals and seeds. So that's the backstory for Lemurian seed crystals.
So, wait, why do they have a masculine energy? Like, it's the little things in this that really hang me up. And I'm like, hold on. Just wait one second.
The amount of detail is simultaneously so wild and yet, like,
But why?
You're like, why are we going with this? There's so much that you're telling me, but what is it?
Why lemurs? Why do you want lemurs?
Why wicker baskets?
Meanwhile, lemur is chomping down on a
millipede.
And I was like, stone. I'm not watching the crystals. Don't leave them in my hands. I'm not paying attention to them, you know? No wonder the dinosaurs stole them, lemurs. It's all your fault.
They were getting roasted.
How appropriate to bring the history of Lemuria onto Hightailing Through History.
It really actually worked out well, and that was not planned.
It explains so much now. It's like a whole new world opening up.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, thank you so much for that. And I really encourage people to, you gave us a beautiful little timeline there, but there's so much in this book, and there, like, all these little details that like make you go, wait, what? I mean, just absolutely hooked. And you did a fantastic job writing it too. So bravo you. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much. Yay.
Hello, this is Laurel, your trip sitter. Don't worry, you're safe in your wicker basket as it lands back down on Earth. Holy smokes. Do you feel like you're on drugs after listening to that? And that's real history. Absolutely bananas, but real history. Thank you to Justin McHenry for coming on and delighting us with a taste of his book, Lemuria, A True Story of a Fake Place, which you can pick up now at your favorite bookstores. We have links to Justin's book and his social media accounts so you can connect with him and see what else he's up to. And while you're at it, if you're not following us on social media, please give us a follow. We have our show news up there and little history videos that we like to call history one hitters. But it's also a great way to get in contact with us and connect. Please say hi. We love chatting with our friends in the smoke circle. And if you are loving the show, please, please, pretty please be sure to leave us a rating and review wherever it is that you are listening. The more stars and reviews that get left for our little indie history show, the better it does in podcast charts, and it gets pushed to more history lovers like you. Let's grow this show together, and we would absolutely not be able to do it without you, so thank you for a successful second season, which saw us grow in subscribers as well as hit our 10,000 downloads mark. And we started a Patreon. We call it our Best Buds Club. Get it? Come be a best bud and get behind the scenes content, mini episodes, we call those our half-baked episodes, as well as early access to our regular episodes so you lucky ducks can listen 2 days earlier than anyone else. How about that? A bunch of other fun stuff is included too. So come check us out over at patreon.com/hightailingthroughhistory. We also have that linked in our show notes next to our social media. And the show is not over, of course. We still have two more stories from history. Up next, Katie takes us to Australia as its military wages war against a mighty foe, a 6-foot-tall flightless bird called the emu.
After that, Justin has a bonus story that ventures into true crime that's only briefly mentioned in his book. So the Smoke Circle gets a special deep look into that true crime Lemuria story. You ready? All right, back in the wicker basket, deep breath, spark it up, and let's puff puff pass it on to part two.
Okay, so in the 1930s, America, we experienced the Great Depression. I'm sure we've all heard of it. Simultaneously, we experienced the Dust Bowl. So it was actually four separate droughts that hit throughout the 1930s. And believe it or not, we're going to totally depart from America and we're going to go to Australia. And it was also, and the whole world was, the whole world was affected by the Great Depression. Not only was it just America's economic downturn, but then all economies tied to it also hit a slump as well. So it was just kind of a Great Depression kind of across the globe, which also affected Australia due to drought. You know, that's just happening. Apparently, it's just happening all over the world. The 1930s was just a terrible time. Hopefully, that's not a precursor for us. So, hopefully, the 2030s are a lot better. The roaring 20s haven't quite measured up yet, but at least we skipped prohibition. Due to the drought and other factors during the Great Depression, farmers were encouraged to grow more wheat. So, in Australia, because there's a lot of struggling agriculture in America. They need to fill in the gap, right? We need more agriculture. So the government also kind of hands them out a little, a little carrot on a stick and says, we'll help you out in the form of subsidies if you guys grow it. So the Australian government subsidizing growing wheat. So it's in the Campion district. It's like the bottom left of Australia. So the southwest section. So where Perth is, it's just to the right of that. The east would be the proper term. and it's like this whole like little like squared out section, right? That's about where we're at. That emerged as the wheat belt of Australia. Okay. That's where like all of that agriculture happened. So farming within this region was actually dominated by discharged veterans from World War I because Australia did fight in World War I. We went over this in our Bloody Baron episode.
Anzacs. Anzacs, that's the name of the Australia, New Zealand.
Best little hats.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. So they get out of World War II, the government goes, hey, you want to be a part of our like farming program? And they're like, all right. I mean, like, what else have I got to do at this point? So only problem with that is, as I'm sure most people can imagine, they had a general lack of knowledge of like what to do. So like they struggled basically. Like it's a good idea, a good thought to put people to work, give them jobs, a living and a livelihood for themselves. But they struggled because nobody knew the craft. You know, if you don't know how to farm and garden, you're not going to know what to look out for because a lot of times it's a generational thing that's taught. So it didn't go super well. and as if to add to the already struggling ex-soldiers' woes, there came yet another threat on their livelihoods. It destroyed their fences, decimated their crops, and worse, it allowed other vermin through, because the fences were built to keep out like rabbits and smaller stuff. It bashed it through. Hang in there, everybody, just stay buckled up because there's going to be a grand reveal. So so it allowed all other types of vermin and pests come in to finish annihilating the crops, so there was nothing left to cultivate for a livable wage, right? So it's a problem. So in November of 1932, members of the Royal Australian Artillery travel to the Campion district. It's like champion without the C, so I believe it's Campion.
Wait, it's champion without the C?
Without the H. Nope.
Okay.
I'm inebriated. I was like, wait, that sounds wrong.
I was visually looking at it in my head and like in front of me, and I was like, Gotcha. Okay.
Champion without the H.
There you go.
That's the second letter. So they travel to the Campion District to face off against this most devious and nefarious of enemies. Armed with automatic machine guns, 10,000 rounds of ammunition, they employed tactics to ambush and lay waste to the enemy. But to no avail, my dear listeners, for the enemy was too quick, too cunning, too agile, and over the wild terrain for the soldiers to compete with these most worthy of opponents. Who is responsible for such widespread wanton destruction, you ask? I'm here to tell you. An adversary so unscrupulous that nearly a quarter of the veterans had actually already deserted the land before the military even arrived. The enemy stands at 6 feet and 3 inches tall, 1.9 meters for our international audience, okay, with a long neck and legs and a robust bipedal runner that can run at great distances and has an insatiable hunger. We are, of course, talking about the emu.
The emu war.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. If my chair doesn't like have me pinned between my desk and the wall directly behind me, I would get up and do like a lap of like, yeah, the story. This is amazing. Oh my God.
It's happening.
Oh, nice.
It's come to hightailing through history.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
So for those that don't know, although I'm guessing most of us do, an emu is essentially a smaller cousin of Africa's ostrich. So a little smaller. A 6 foot tall bird with daggers on its feet, essentially. Emu, however, are generally more docile than ostrich, which are a little more territorial. But if cornered, they will still turn and kick and fight, and it could result in disembowelment. Fun fact, kangaroos can do the same thing. So basically, just don't try to pet anything in Australia is really the only bit of information I can give you.
Like literally everything will kill you there. Even the flightless birds will.
Oh yeah. And fun fact, the most dangerous bird on Earth actually is Australia's other large flightless bird, the cassowary.
That's what I was looking up now. That's what I was like, what's the one that starts with a C?
Cassowary. Like, I got you. Cassowary. I was already there.
So, yeah.
Now, does that have an H in it or no?
It doesn't. Nope. There's no H's. There are a couple of S's.
Okay.
And autocorrect did have to help me because there's an O and I put an A. So. Such is life. So each year during the breeding season, the emu migrates hundreds of kilometers over the course of the year for search of food and water. And like, it's a migratory animal, right? Wildebeests do the same thing in, Africa? And the Canadian goose does the same thing here, as well as the common robin. So here we are in America.
Wait, you're saying this can happen here with robins?
Well, robins, listen, if it does, we're probably going to have the same result that Australia did.
Oh my gosh.
Just watch out. Okay, so in 1932, an unusually large migration swept across this unsuspecting section of land. It was caused by another drought. Imagine that. The theme is droughts. And it caused massive damage to the crops in Western Australia, obviously, particularly in the Campion District, because that's where a lot of the farming was happening. So because of the drought, more emus had to move further than they normally would have, brought them more into contact with sections that they normally would avoid because they would have more natural resources available if there was no drought. So the Australian government changed the emu status from that of a protected native species to vermin in response destruction of large amounts of vital crops, such as wheat. Extremely vital if you're a bourbon drinker. Emus frequently broke through the farmers' fences, creating holes that allowed pests such as rabbits and other small varmints to do more damage. Furthermore, emus ate the crops voraciously, and whatever they didn't eat, they trampled it down, causing even more damage to it. So even anything that was growing nearby, it got flattened because they're not small, decently large birds. Mm-hmm. Found out, though, from watching my doc poll that I watch on my Nat Geo Wild, like the best way to approach an emu is to like bend over at the waist and sidle up to them because they see that as non-threatening. Whereas if you were to like stand up like that, that's their body language sign that like something is afoot and that it's like time to run. So they'll get all panicked and like run away. So if you crouch down, not crouch down, but like bend over at your waist and walk right up to them, you can just toss an arm right over them.
Does that work for any other species?
I didn't see him do it with any others, so I'm going to not do
there. Okay, like truckers, you're supposed to approach a trucker like that? Or?
I believe those you approach with a Slim Jim. No. And that's how you. Okay, you snap into it, and then you just hear Macho Man, and like, oh, yeah, and the truckers are like. All right, emus. So, well, farmers were permitted to shoot the emus themselves, their resources were limited, leading them to request government assistance. So the Minister of Defense, you know it's a big deal when your military gets involved. The Minister of Defense, George Pierce, believed that dispatching professional soldiers to help the farmers would demonstrate that the government took these veterans' concerns very seriously. On November 4th, 1932, the soldiers laid an ambush for the emus at a water source. The gunners waited to open fire until thousands of emus were in range. However, one of the guns jammed after just a few rounds and the emus quickly scattered. No sooner had the conflict began than it became clear that the Australian military had vastly underestimated the emu. Cunning adversaries, the emus proved almost impossible to hit with machine gun fire. Wild, and they seemed able to even shrug off serious injuries from bullets without breaking stride. They just kept going. So, yeah. So they have a really, like, tough skin, and I guess I should, like, shouldn't be that surprised, because for some reason in the horse world, there was a craze there for a while on, like, the Western, which is, like, with the horn where the cowboy ties the rope to. Everything was made out of ostrich leather.
Huh. Okay.
So, like, I'm sitting there and I'm like, I could see that because I have myself used and been in contact with ostrich leather, which I would assume is at least similar. It's at least a starting point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, these things, like, I didn't put it in here because it was kind of a aggressive way to say it, but I get it because they're culling these animals, right? Culling them, so they're gonna, you know, they are obviously hunting the animals, but like the way the guy described, like trying to hit them, it's like you could only hit them like, and like it, like basically in the head is what he was saying. He just said it a little bit more aggressively, and I was like,
tiny head.
That's not a very good time, but I guess if you hit them anywhere else, they just wouldn't stop. They'd just keep going. Yeah.
The Terminator.
They are Terminator birds. So true.
Like, they got dinosaur feet, too. They're real sharp.
Yeah, they got claws on there, man. Whew. No, thank you. I'll keep my bowels right where they are, thank you.
Inside my body, thank
indeed.
You.
Indeed. Yeah. That's in where there. They will stay. So the emus feature on Australia's coat of arms, ironically enough, this is a symbol of Australia. The long-necked, shaggy-coated, flightless birds can run at about 50 kilometers an hour. For those of us in America, I think it was about 30, 35. And to give you reference, race horses are about 40 to 45, which is about what an ostrich runs. So they're just a little slower than those guys. Just a little bit.
But faster than me.
Yes, definitely faster than you. Random fun fact that I just wanted to include, they communicate by drumming, grunting, and booming through an inflatable neck sack, and it can be heard up to 2 kilometers away.
Wow.
So there you go.
Like a velociraptor?
Probably.
That's been running through my mind ever since you said, like, the disembowelment. Like, I just kept thinking of, like, Sam Neill doing that to that kid. At the very beginning of Jurassic Park.
Actually, in the book, Michael Crichton's book of Jurassic Park, there is a very vividly described disembowelment scene.
Yeah.
But as we know, as I said to you before, Laurel, it's not actually Velociraptor. It's the Deinonychus, I believe is what I said. Yeah, which is actually what Velociraptors in Jurassic Park, Justin, are fashioned after. They're the bigger version of Velociraptor, but Velociraptor's a cooler name. So the 6-foot turkey got pasted onto Deinonychus's body, and now here we are.
How's the army getting out there? Because that's like in the middle of nowhere, Australia. I know Perth is way out on its own.
Yeah, it's all the way on the left. Trucks come into it here in just a second because the war is not over, my dears.
Okay.
It's still going. Yes?
I have a quick question. So you said that the emu was part of their
coat of arms.
I'm assuming this has been in existence longer than it wasn't like after the skirmish with the emus. They were like, no. You know what? Let's add them to our coat of arms because they're a bunch of
the treaty that ended the war was they had to be added to the coat of arms.
I believe it was around before that because everyone talked about the irony of they're like, this is a symbol of Australia. Why are we trying to kill it? And it's like, well, also, you know, they're like decimating our crops. So, you know.
Yeah. I think I assumed as much, but it just would feel like a very fun Australian thing to do to add it in.
Put it on later. Yeah. We lost to a mate. You got to add him now. So describing the emus later, Major Meredith said, if we had a military division with the bullet carrying capacity of these birds, it would face any army in the world. They can face machine guns with the invulnerability of tanks. They're unstoppable, dude.
Yeah.
Which, why the military? I love horses, right? Ridden them since I was six. So, cavalry, but ostriches. Why have we not had this thought before? I'm just saying, obviously the emu has proved, I don't know if emus could handle much more than someone my size, though, because they're only about, 80 to 90 pounds. They're not that big.
Oh, yeah.
But, well, and 6 feet tall, so I mean it's a plenty big bird, but
an emu is only 80 to 90 pounds.
Yeah, they're not that heavy. The cassowary is much heavier and much more deadly, so when it kicks you, it kicks with like twice the force of an emu. Ugh. Those are, you want to talk about a velociraptor, cassowary. Look at their feet. Yeah. Google a cassowary feet right now, just do that for me because it's incredible.
Yeah. Is it because I'm sorry. I'm just having a hard time imagining that an emu is lighter than me. 80 to 90 pounds, right?
I mean, you don't.
I'm not trying to question you. I'm sorry.
It's all in their ass, dude. Otherwise, they're just legs and necks. So there you go.
Okay. All right.
And their necks are inflatable too. So it's
okay. That's true. It's like they're like a wicker basket, basically. Yes.
That's what they wrote down.
Yeah.
Imagine like you're in the bush and you just like look down and just see that foot like walking by you. It's just
and
like,
then you just look up and the little like head comes up
Clever girl.
Yeah.
The mighty emu. So a few days into these operations, a planned ambush by a dam failed miserably when one of Lewis's guns jammed. A later attempt to mount a machine gun on a truck fell apart when it was made apparent that the vehicle could not keep up with the birds. They could outrun them. Yeah. And I guess there was an incident where one truck actually got destroyed when it hit an emu, but yeah. That's the only like sad part is there obviously are casualties in this war as there are in any war. But yeah, poor emus. You just got to feel for them a little bit. They're just burdened around.
Yeah, they just need to eat too, you know.
You know? I feel for him, man. Mm-hmm. So within the first week of contact, the troops were recalled. Fastest war in history. Roughly 2,500 rounds had been fired and killed somewhere between 50 to 200 emus. That was it. They were trying to take out like about 20,000 of them, and they managed 200. Yeah. Meredith did note that his men had suffered no casualties, though. When the question was raised if a medal should be struck for the conflict, the federal labor parliamentarian A.E. Green replied that any medals should go to the emus who had won every round so far. For his involvement in the deployment, Defense Minister George Pierce earned the unofficial title of the Minister for the Emu War. Yeah. So make no mistake that Australia is well aware of this.
Oh,
indeed. Ultimately, the emus were considered the victors of the war. By 1934, the government had begun to simply supply farmers with ammunition and had created bounties for the emu hunting. Roughly 57,000 bounties for dead emus were claimed within 6 months. Wow. So they should have just done that in the first place.
Yeah.
Looking back, in July of 1953, 2 decades after the war, Sydney Sunday Herald wrote, "The enemy is a tough, prolific, gangling marauder of the sand plains whose species, ever since the beginning beginning of agriculture in the state has invaded, in a frenzy of hunger, some of the finest fields at the time of ripening of the harvest to shear off the crops with the voracious beaks and to trample with great webbed feet 100 plants into the earth for each one eaten.
Wow.
This person. Oh my gosh.
I know. Although a second, slightly more military operation was mounted against the emus only a few days after the initial retreat in 1932. In the end, it instituted a bounty on the emus, which was just the easier way of handling it. So between 1945 and 1960, 284,700 emus were killed in West Australia. Hunted, what? Like, oh. I mean, so like how we do here, you get your hunter's license, you get a bag, you know, how many. So with bounties, it's more of like, you know, like get six or, I mean, we do it actually in the Florida Everglades. That's a great way to put it. There's bounties on the pythons out there because they're not a naturally occurring species. Okay. And you just bag them and tag them and you'll get paid for bringing pythons because they're so destructive to alligators and a lot of prey animals that super ridiculously critically endangered species like the Florida panther rely on to survive. So, you know, problem. Yeah. So a lot like that where there's bounties on it and you can get paid for keeping the population in check. So by 1953, the West Australian government had resorted to forking out $52,000 for a 215 kilometer, about 135 mile, emu-proof fence as a part of the war being continually raged against a creature regarded at home and abroad as the national symbol of Australia.
Build the fence.
So, I mean, find a peaceful solution, right? Don't keep gunning down emus, man.
Yeah.
So the emu fence, adapted from an existing fence, originally constructed to try to keep the rabbits out of the agriculture area, is now the state barrier fence. It's still up for more than 1,200 kilometers. It still plays a critical role in stopping the birds. It's still in use today because it's still a problem.
Oh my.
Australia's emu population, however, remains stable to this day. You'll both be pleased to hear. Thankfully, they do not seem interested in resuming hostilities with the Australian government. And that, my dears, is the story of the Great Emu War of Australia.
Oh, love it. Love it. They took a bunny fence and just like enlarged it by... Yeah, like add 5 feet to it. And that would do it.
Just steps over.
Right? I was like, how? I mean, I don't know. I feel like living in Australia, you'd be like, listen, that's probably going to be a problem. That's a big bird.
Yeah, right.
I mean, deer are destructive here. Like, if you've got crops, they'll eat them all. You've got little sapling trees, they'll eat the bark off of that. So, like, herbivores can do damage too, you know.
Yeah, and bunnies are very
bunnies. Yeah,
yes.
Do a lot of damage too.
But yeah, ask Napoleon.
You have to do with bunnies and emus though. So.
Yeah. So the fence is—it's still up. It's doing its job as it has for decades.
And
oh my gosh,
peace is restored in the kingdom. The national symbol of Australian pride, intact. No longer at war with its governing body. So,
important to make a medal.
Right?
There's one true crime story in my book. It all revolves around a sex worker, a wannabe cult leader, and a killing that happens inside Los Angeles' City Hall in 1898. And so I'll tell you all about that because it's crazy and wild. I only like touch upon it in the book, but I go a little bit deeper. And I wrote a blog on it. And so the lady is, her name was Teresa Kerr, and she was a sex worker in LA. She had moved from the East to California and was in, she's in like a brothel there. And so this John comes. A guy by the name of George King, and he becomes infatuated with her, right? And so he keeps coming back and, you know, patronizing her over and over again. until he kind of just starts love bombing her too, wanting her to, you know, like basically get in a relationship with him. And so, so she finally like caves in and says, okay, let's do this. And so they live together for a few months. But they're like under assumed names just because George King is, the son of a, like a scion of Los Angeles area. Like he was, his dad was like a judge there in the county or in the city. He was like founded one of the, like the suburb towns in around the valley there. So he was really like a big political figure in the area. And his son had like, you know, political ambitions as well. His son worked in like the engineering department of the city. And so, so he was keeping that secret, his relationship secret with her, just because I guess you don't want to it known that you're, you know, shacking up with a former sex worker. And so she gets out of that life. She starts just basically becoming his paramour. And they enter into it's kind of weird. It's not like an official marriage per se. They had like a written contract with one another, or they just wrote up an agreement with one another until around like November of 1898. And he wants to like run for office. And then all of his friends and his family starts telling him, you know, you gotta ditch this lady. She's not good for your image and stuff like that.
And
around Christmas time, he completely ghosts her. And so it was like day after Christmas, he says goodbye. And
last Christmas, I gave you my heart.
Exactly. And so she spends days and days just like wondering what happened to him. Like, is he coming back? And like, it was like engineering department. So he's like, you know, it's kind of dangerous because you're going out and, you know, crawling around and. So she doesn't know if he's dead or not. She starts calling his office. She starts writing letters to his office to try to get some response. She's not hearing anything. So like 3 or 4 days goes by. She's at her wit's end. And so she goes down to City Hall herself and like she pays like a page to go and see if he's in his office. He's in his office. So she waits at City Hall all day long. And she had brought a gun with her. She had actually pawned her wedding ring or ring to get a gun, like in that time she was waiting. And so she's sitting there waiting.
Well, that's what he did emotionally, man, by ghosting her. So goes around, comes around, bub.
Exactly. And that is exactly what she says to him when he steps out of his office at like closing time, right? So she walks up to him on the steps and be like, you did this to me. Look at all you did. You tore me up. All this inside. And because you did that, I'm going to kill myself. And so she pulls out the gun and like puts it to her breast. He grabs it and there's a struggle going on, right?
Oh boy.
And it goes off and it shoots him and he hangs on for a few days, but he ends up dying. Right. Okay.
Oh.
So cut to, that's all happening in Los Angeles, right? So cut to Santa Barbara, California, a month later. There is a newspaper man there, a guy by the name of Frederick Spencer Oliver, and he runs across this story and he sees this story of a sex worker on hard times. And it automatically clicks with them because it is the fulfillment of all of his prophecies that he's been talking about for the last 20 years. So Frederick Spencer Oliver, when he was a teenager living around Mount Shasta, he was surveying. He was surveying a piece of land for his father, and as he was taking notes, this spiritual entity like entered him, and he started like automatic writing through him. And so he freaks out. Oh, Frederick, he was running home, and in the weeks and days later, he comes to like know who the spiritual entity is. It's a spirit by the name of Phylos. Is what he goes by.
Like the dough?
Kind of, yeah, like Philo.
Like baklava?
Yeah, okay. Like with a S at the end.
Got it.
But Philos is a Tibetan though. So not quite in the Mediterranean area.
There's actually like a phylos, like this is a food item?
Yeah. Like, he's not like the food itself. It's not like a spiritual food.
Okay, gotcha.
Drink his bed. Yeah, I can talk into him.
The idea of that, though, is that would hilarious.
Gotta write that one down. So he starts basically channeling this entity, right? And over time, he like introduces the phylos to his parents. And people start like gathering from around and listening to what Phylos has to say. So he gets like this little mini following around him. And then Phylos wants Frederick to write a book for him. And so he does. He channels this book. It's one of the earliest channeled like works out there. The book comes to be called A Dweller on Two Planets. And it tells this just the thumbnail sketch of it is amazing. So it tells the story of an Atlantean, someone from Atlantis, nobleman, who gets into a love triangle with two Atlantean women. The Atlantean women like get in a fight and stuff like that. One turns into a statue. The Atlantean nobleman like broods around in his airship. So it's a kind of like UFO. It basically looks like a early UFO that also is a submarine. And then he passes away. He learns some lessons along the way. But he gets reincarnated in the 1850s as Walter Pearson, right? So to go from an Atlantean nobleman to someone reincarnated as Walter is a huge step down. Not in the, hopefully you don't have any Walters in your life that I'm making fun of.
Okay. No.
But Walter, he serves in the Civil War, then he goes out to California and like strikes it rich in like the mining industry in California. But one day while he was around Mount Shasta himself, he meets up with a mystical Chinese man who takes him within Mount Shasta, and then he gets astrally projected to Venus, and they have like And he has like this magical mystical tour in Venus, right? and this is where the idea that Mount Shasta is a like hollowed out mountain full of these ascended beings comes from, as well. And that's why it makes it into the book. But as part of that, Walter Pearson and his Chinese friend, they meet a former sex worker who's also an alcoholic, and they like rehabilitate her and give her money, and they set her on the path of, you know, a better path in life, I guess. And so after he gets done with his astral projections to Venus and stuff like that, he's a changed man. And you know, years later, he meets up with this former sex worker that he had saved. And they fall in love, and they get married, and that's it. Oh, so that sounds like an amazing story, right? But that's like five pages of this like 500-page book that's like nothing but like esoteric Christianity teachings as well. Boy. And so it's really boring and really, really not worth a read.
It's really boring.
It's really, it sucks really bad. But Frederick had spent decades now trying to get this book published. He sent it off to publishers in New York, and like the train crashed and the book burned up in the train crash. Oh, wow. He had one of his followers, who was a local district attorney, act as a literary agent for him and like go around Los Angeles trying to get it sold, but it would not sell. So no one wanted to
do it. Seems like the powers that be are trying to say something here.
Exactly. And so that's where Frederick at in 1899 now, where he hears the story of Teresa Kerr. And he just like, oh, wow, this is my story come to life.
It's come to life. Reality.
And so she's...
I'm a prophet. I was right.
Exactly.
So
while she's in jail, right? So she's still in jail waiting trial. He starts trying to worm his way into her life and into her defense team. And so the first thing, he sends down his lawyer/literary agent to talk to her defense team to like try to take over the case, like try to like have him take over the case. He offers them lots of money and stuff like that to do it. They say thanks, but no thanks. Next, he sends down his mother to them in a scheme to have his mother adopt this woman. So she's like a late 20s woman, just so they can become official family and then they can do it. That failed, of course. Then he sends his wife down because he's married at the time with two children. He sends his wife down and his wife pleads with her, or his wife sends a letter to her or the defense team and saying, you should like become a part of the family. Like we need you to become part of the family. My husband like desperately like needs you to be like, we have nothing but love for you. We want nothing but the best for you. You need to do this.
That just when you thought your day couldn't get any weirder.
Yeah, right.
What?
And then that fails. And then he goes down there himself and tries to talk the I don't know what his ultimate aim was when his talk with the lawyers, but he was like, I just have nothing but sisterly affection. I think he used those terms, sisterly affection for this woman, and she is like, I just need to, you know, be a part of her life. But that all fails, right? So his story ends for a little bit. Her trial happens, and it's like they go over her story and all of that stuff. They lay down very clearly all of the like emotional trauma that this guy had put her through and stuff like that. And so it took the jury like only 9 minutes to acquit her. And then she goes on and she marries another guy and kind of just like fades into history. I mean, wasn't quite able to like reach out and see what happened to her, but he would end up dying later in that same year too. And so without his book being published, and he died of cirrhosis of the liver. And so like, maybe gives you some idea of where he was at mentally. But yeah, his book would be published by his mother 6 years later after his death. And then another 20 years after that, it would not be until it was like be republished and then find a audience within like this alternative spiritual like world of California and become like the basis for all the Mount Shasta lore and all of the like underground stuff that was going on as to like Hollow Earth. So that's my true crime story.
Whoa.
What?
My face. We are just getting hit from all angles with the amazing history today.
It's a season finale. You have to bring out the stuff.
It is a season finale. Yeah. I think so too. Yeah. Wow. Oh my goodness. I'm gobsmacked. I'm speechless.
Yeah.
I'm loved it. So excited about that.
The other interesting thing was, you know, Perry Mason, like the character Perry Mason. So he is based on a lawyer, Earl Stanley. I forget the lawyer's name, but he was one of the prosecuting attorneys in that case. It was one of his first
interesting
cases. And then he would go on to be the inspiration for Perry Mason.
Perry Mason? Yeah. Who's Perry Mason?
He's like a 1920s, 1930s lawyer figure, like detective stories and stuff like that. Like it was, he was like a lawyer detective and doing that kind
of
stuff.
So like old time radio, he was probably
Yes. And there was a long, long, long ass running TV show from like the 1940s up until like 1960s of Perry Mason.
Yeah, what an interesting connection that is there too. I mean, I feel like so much has been connected. Like you said, it's like a blank slate to paint your picture on and paint your stories on top of and
that's about all you can say to this episode.
Wow.
I'm so glad I've journeyed here in my wicker basket to to hear about the history of Lemuria and also the Emu War in Australia, which the fact that they're like, should we make a medal for this? Like, do we give a medal to our men for the, you know, and very seriously considered it, I think is amazing. Wow, what a wild ride. That was so great for our season finale of season two.
This has easily been the best wake and bake I have ever done, you guys. This was wild.
Yeah,
Making dreams come true.
Even dreams I didn't know I had.
Well, thank you all so much for joining us for not only today, but for season two. We've loved having you along for the wild ride in our wicker basket. We're going to be off for 6 weeks. We'll still be on social media and stuff like that. So please connect with us on there. We have all of our social media in the show notes. So just scroll down there, click it. There we are. We'll be back with you again in 6 weeks, which will be April 19th. So just in time for 420 for us all to celebrate. It's again the smoke circle.
It's 420 Eve. It's often like the most magical time, really.
It really is. Cookies out. Mm-hmm. Not where others can eat them.
Gotta leave your cookies out for Willie Nelson and like Snoop Dogg to come and, you know, hang. Come and have some cookies. Thank you once again to Justin McHenry. And folks, in the meantime, get money, get high, give love. And Katie?
Whatever mode of transportation you do not use wicker baskets. Okay, that's all I got for you.
Just say no to wicker baskets.
Emu transportation.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.